is review something that Rav Nachman of Bratslav said, which I think is very interesting. The beginning of the parasha, the parasha of Bechukotai, is the parasha of the Tochacha. Tochacha means that in the agreement between Bnei Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you understand the end of the parasha, the end of the book of Vayikra, could have been the introduction to Bnei Yisrael going into Eretz Yisrael. It's true that Bamidbar Naso, Bahalotcha, are sort of like organizing things for the trek in the desert. But that trek would have been ended right with those parshiyot, except that Shlach, Bamidbar Naso, Bahalotcha, they taught me in high school, I remember, Ben Pasak. If you remember that, you know the order of the parshiyot. Bamidbar Naso, Bahalotcha, Shlach, Korach. Shlach is the parasha of the Meraglim. The parasha of Meraglim changes Jewish history because it introduces a 40-year sojourn in the desert. If not for the parasha of Shlach, they would have come into Eretz Yisrael pretty much after this parasha of Bechukotai. So the parasha of Bechukotai contains the new covenant, a different kind of covenant. Har Sinai was also a covenant, and the covenant with Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov were also a covenant. But now there's another kind of covenant, not another kind, but different kinds of details. And this covenant says, in Bechukotai Telechu, right, the first Pesukim in the parasha, good things are going to happen to you. And if you don't follow the laws of the Torah, bad things are going to happen to you. And the bad things are enumerated. They're enumerated. And it would seem that this covenant in the parasha of Bechukotai is cancelled by the Meraglim. It's cancelled by the act of the Meraglim. And then that's why 40 years later, 38 years later, in the parasha of Ki Tavoh, remember the end of the Torah, the end of Dvarim, the parasha of Ki Tavoh, there's another covenant. Not simply a restatement of the old covenant, because it's a little bit different, but you understand that that covenant was reestablished on the eve of Bnei Yisrael going into Eretz Yisrael. So that Bigadol, as they like to say in Israel, right, and if you look at it in the macro, if you look at the macro of the Torah, so you have the stories of the formation of Am Yisrael, Yitzhak Mitzrayim, the building of the Mishkan, all the things associated with the Mishkan, like Tumah v'Tahara, what you can eat, what you can't eat, what you can sacrifice, you can't sacrifice. And finally, now you're ready to go to Eretz Yisrael, the end of Vayikra, our parasha, covenant. And then there's a regression in history, the parasha of Shlach. And then the stories that happened in the Midbar during the 38 years. It's not a history, but there are a few stories that are chosen in the book of Bamidbar. The book of Dvarim is a book that was written about the last days of the life of Moshe Rabbeinu, in which he repeats certain mitzvot, adds other mitzvot, talks about the new obligations that Bnei Yisrael have when they come to Eretz Yisrael, and a new covenant, which is similar to the old covenant, not identical, similar to it, but again, reestablishment, establishing the relationship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Am Yisrael on the eve of the entry into Eretz Yisrael. And finally, they do. They do achieve. They are able to enter. They're able to go into Eretz Yisrael, something that they missed out on. It's like two times. They did it twice. So that the promise was resilient. The promise to Avraham Avinu was so resilient that even after Bnei Yisrael rejected the promise. Right? You know, the story, you could look at the story of the Torah as a story of rejection. You know, Bnei Yisrael rejected the Torah by building the Egel HaZahav. Okay, you could say it wasn't a total rejection, it was a partial rejection, but it's primarily the story of the failure of Mitzrayim, of the slavery and the exodus of Mitzrayim to produce the worthy result. The worthy result, the Gemara said, would be to start over again. That the Am Yisrael standing at Har Sinai should have been like Adam and Chava, so the Gemara says, in Gan Eden. Which means a new beginning. Everything starts over again. But B'nai Yisrael wasn't up to it. So even if you know that God will forgive you or accept your repentance or allow you atonement, you know for sure that's going to happen. It doesn't mean that you're up to it. It doesn't mean you're going to do it, that you can really do it. So that was the Torah, the rejection of the Torah, and continued rejection of Moshe Rabbeinu in the years in the desert, which also was a rejection of Torah, because Torah could only exist if you accept the authority of the representatives of the Torah. Otherwise you don't have a Torah, because the Torah can't breathe. Even though, you know, it's common sometimes for frum people to say that the Torah never changes. They don't mean that. The Torah has to change, because the Torah has to be relevant all the time. It has to respond to reality. If it can't respond to reality, it's going to disappear right away. So when you say that the Torah doesn't change, you mean that there's an essential Torah. And around that essential Torah, there are things changing all the time. All the time. The Rambam says, when God gave the Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe Rabbeinu had to teach the Torah to the generations, but that included takanot and minhagim and gezerot, you know those words that are used for rabbinic innovation, right? Rabbinic innovation could not mean let's do away with Shabbat and do something else, but it could mean let's accept new kinds of regulations and obligations which are appropriate for the generation in which we live. Also leniencies, even though it's true that being religious is a very conservative enterprise. You know, we're always very nostalgic about the previous generation. I once asked Shlomo Kalman, I said, how come you never did anything? It's my impression. This is what I said. So if I'm wrong, don't correct me. I said, how come you're like so modern and with it? You never did anything. You never said, let's do something. Something that other people don't do. He says, you never said that. So he says, I want to know. That's why I talked about mechitza. That was the topic. It was a mechitza, the shul. He was davening in the sukkahs in his father's shul on 79th Street in Manhattan. It was a shul, small shul. And there was a big mechitza. And you know, a lot of girls there. And they all like trying to get across the mechitza to the other side to see what's really going on. Of course, it's terrible when they find out there's nothing going on. But so I said, how come you didn't do something like take down the mechitza or something, or like make it more liberal? He said, I want to make sure that if the Baba of a Rebbe comes to daven in my shul, that he'll stay. You know, so he said, there's an innate conservatism that we have. And even if you think this is all right, and that's all right, and the other thing's all right, you want to make sure your grandparents would be happy about davening in the shul. That's like part of the nature of our enterprise. All right. So B'nai Yisrael in the desert were failing and succeeding and failing and succeeding, right? The Kabbalistic notion behind that is Ratzon V'Shov. That's how people are. They do good things and then they regress. They move on and they regress. In a Hegelian sort of way, the idea is always to be moving a few centimeters ahead. Like the big splurt is not as important as the difference between what used to be and what is now. In between, you could have all kinds of, you know. I saw somebody. I don't know why I'm doing this. Somebody showed me that some magazine, either Forward, had the 50 most influential rabbis in America. Had a list. I was so happy that I didn't know any of them. But I said to me, there's like 1,000 rabbis in America who are not influential. I felt that was sad, right? I mean, how could you have so many rabbis who don't influence anything? But this is a problem. Like, you're dealing with an amorphous organism called the Jewish people, and everybody has ideas. Everybody has their own ideas. Everybody thinks they're right. Everybody knows what the best thing for everybody else would be. And this creates a difficulty. That's the same thing happened in the desert. We accepted that tradition. So let's go again. I just want to remind you, in Bechukotai, there's a covenant. That covenant was the covenant of the set of Israel before they were supposed to enter Eretz Israel. They didn't enter Eretz Israel. The Baraglim, the punishment, the 38 years wandering around in the desert, all of that took place at the beginning of the book of Bamidbar and canceled out the covenant. Now, in this canceled covenant, there's an interesting point that God makes. If you look at the sheet, right, the first thing, but Pasuk Gimel, forget about Aleph and Bet, the parasha begins in Pasuk Gimel. It says, "Ein bechukotai teilechu, ved mitzvotai teshberu v'asitem otam." Chukot are the laws, and mitzvotai teshberu v'asitem otam. That's what it says. Pasuk Gimel in the Rashi. See, sort of halfway, the second or the first wide line in the Rashi. Im bechukotai telechu, chozek kiyum ha-mitzvot. Could this mean that you should keep the mitzvot? The second half of the pasuk says mitzvotai shnishmaru. So the first part of the pasuk must be talking about something else. Can't be talking about mitzvot. Hare kiyum ha-mitzvot amur. Ha mani mikayem im bechukotai telechu shetiyu ameilim batorah. So if you have a mikraot gedolot at home, you take out your mikraot gedolot and you look at the perush of the Orach Chaim of this pasuk, and you'll see that it stretches in the mikraot gedolot for 6 pages. What is it that the Orach Chaim is explaining to us? What ameilim batorah means? And interestingly enough, in my opinion, this became the linchpin of the ideology developed by Bnei Yisrael in the Middle Ages. Right? Of course, it was started by the Tanaim after the Churban Beit HaMikdash, but it was expanded and enhanced by the Rishonim at the time of Rashi, right? And later than Rashi, Ameilim BaTorah. Ameilim BaTorah, if I look at, here, I look here. This is Art Scroll I'm looking at. And you shall study them, and you shall observe them to perform them. No, Amenat. 3. Mitzvotai Tishmor, and you shall study them. You shall observe them to perform them. So that this idea of being a Ameilim BaTorah, to work hard, to work at Torah learning, this was an idea. This was an idea. In other words, the reasonable position is that if you are able to do it, you should do it. If you're talented at it, then you should kind of become a rabbinic personality. Instead, we developed this very interesting ideology that learning Torah is its own, doesn't have to be defended. In every field, there's a system by which people who are not appropriate are weeded out. You can't study math if you can't do the math problems, right? You can't It doesn't work out. So how do they do it at the university? They try to keep you in for the BA, so you'll pay tuition. But then they get rid of you. When the universities start having to give scholarships, so then they only give to excellence. When you pay tuition, they figure out a way to keep you going for the BA. So Torah learning is the opposite. The people who are really brilliant, we're not worried about, because they take care of themselves. It's all the other people. How do we keep them doing it, even though they really are not so extraordinarily talented? This became the educational linchpin of the Jewish people, right? And today people, they keep doing it. They keep doing it even today. I mean, there are today they're developing shivot for kids who have a little attention span, kids who take Ritalin every day. But it doesn't matter what's wrong with you. Just stay in yeshiva and learn Torah. But this kind of idea, which is anybody, you go on the street, you find some non-Jewish educator, will tell you in a minute that this is madness. And all of this madness goes into this Rashi, that you have to be Amei Lim Batorah. It has nothing to do with whether you're successful or not. I mean, everybody can be a little bit successful, but usually in most areas, people who are not really cut out for it leave the field. They don't study things just because they're there. They can't do it. They can't maintain that kind of standard. So this idea of Amelut Batorah became the ideological watchword. That's what we want. We're not worried about the geniuses. We're not worried about whether they'll be poskim or dayanim or people of great competence, because they don't need us. Us meaning the system of education. They'll educate themselves. Right? They take care of themselves. Listen to great people, great Jews, great Torah scholars, you find none of them ever went to yeshiva. They all sat at home and learned with their fathers, or sat in the backyard and learned by themselves. They didn't go to yeshiva. They didn't go to yeshiva. Chazon Ish didn't go to yeshiva, and Rabbi Yashar didn't go to yeshiva. And if they went to yeshiva, it had nothing to do with the yeshiva either. They did it all. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein didn't go to yeshiva. They didn't go to yeshiva. Yeshiva is for regular people. Some quite smart, right, clever. But really, the ones who are outstanding, they just sit down and give a Gemara and sit them down someplace and they do it themselves. I remember when this Russian, I mean, I don't know if I should say his name. Anyway, this Russian mathematician came to the yeshiva where I was. He didn't know anything. You know Russians? Well, they don't know anything. They really don't know anything. So he didn't know a thing. So I said, well, we're going to learn Gemara. He said, I said, what do you want to do? He wants to learn the Gemara. Okay, somebody talked him into it. So we started learning Gemara. Whatever Gemara we were learning, I read it and explained it to him. And I said, okay, now read it back to me and explain it to me. So he reads back the Gemara, and I see that his reading is better than my reading. Like, he didn't know anything, but he got it. So I took him, I put him in a corner in the yeshiva, in the base medrash, I put him in a corner. I said, don't talk to anybody. Don't let anybody bother you. Don't go ahead, don't leave your seat. And he did that. And now he knows Shas. And he's a big Talmud Chacham. And I take all the credit. Because I didn't make him go to yeshiva. like that would have been really awful. And spent all this time figuring out what was wrong with what he was taught. That would be a big waste of time. So in any event, this Amelut Batorah is the ideology. That's what it's about. How it became the ideology, you know, you could discuss aspects of it, but that's the ideology. Now, then the Torah goes on. We did Pasuk Gimel, but I found the Gishmei can be done. But I thought I should do love, Eitz, Asadei, Tei, Piri, Yom. We sing Lechem Daish et Patsir, Patsir, Sig et Zara, Vachaltem Lach, Vachem, Lasova, Yishabtem, Lebeta, Vartzachem. So things are going to be great. The land will produce, and you'll have tremendous opportunities And it'll just be great, an economic miracle. It'll be an economic miracle. Then the pasuk that I'm particularly interested in is pasuk Vav. Benatati shalom ta'aretz, ushaftem ve'ein macharid, vishpati chayara abin ha'aretz, v'cherem lo tavor v'atzakar. The first phrase is Natati shalom ba'aretz. I will give you peace, or I will inject or place peace into this land. So now, if you look at the Rashi of Pasuk Vav, the Rashi says, Natati shalom. You see the Rashi? Shema tomru, harei ma'achal, harei ma'mishteh. He says, you come and say, what do I need shalom for? I've got a lot of food, and I've got a lot of drink, and I've got a lot of money, and I'm doing a tremendous business, and I'm conquering the world in all of this. So you say, im ein shalom, ein klum. Im ein shalom, ein klum. That's what Rashi said. The other peace, you don't have anything. Well, what do you mean you don't have anything? Huh? Talmud Lomar, after you have economic well-being, v'natati shalom ba'aretz mikan, from this we learn, shalom shakul k'neged hakol. So what is Rashi talking about? What do you mean shalom? What do you mean shalom? If you have power, and you have economic power, and if you have industrial power, and you have a strong army, what do you need peace for, right? This is our ideology today in Israel, in Eretz Israel. As long as we can beat up on everybody in sight, what difference does it make? And the Pasuk says, no. There's a quality called shalom which supersedes everything else that you might have. And if you don't have shalom, you don't really have anything. Because everything is precarious. And things change all the time. And if there's no peace, the change might work against you. That's what Rashi says. Now, this pasuk remains problematic. Because even though Rashi said what Rashi says, it's not easy for us to understand what exactly the difference is between a nation that is at peace and a nation that is not at peace. As long as you're very successful and have what you want. The Ibn Ezra, you see the second paragraph, I can't read the whole thing, but the Ibn Ezra says, V'natati shalom ba'aretz b'neichem. So the Ibn Ezra says, no, we're not talking about international relations, as Rashi seems to indicate. B'neichem, no Jews, they don't get along. That's the nature of the game. So V'natati shalom, what supersedes economic well-being and industrial independence and having a special place in the world because of your military capacity, what you're going to get is people are going to like each other. Shalom b'neichem. Can you imagine that? People will get along with each other. Right? I don't want to mention the Ethiopian problem in Israel, but I don't have to mention it. The Ramban says, you see the Ramban, the next, so in the third line it says, Al Derech HaEmet, Emet is Kabbalah. Right? In other words, there's another way of thinking about it. Not like Rashi, and not like the Ibn Ezra. So the third line, the Ramban says, Al Derech HaEmet, Sheyitein HaShalom Mechubar Ba'aretz. What do you think of that? Natati shalom ba'aretz literally means peace in the land. Ramban says, what does that mean? That Eretz Yisrael will become kind of connected to peace. That the only way to live in Eretz Yisrael would be if you are at peace. So it's not that you get de facto peace, but you get a situation in which only peace can be winning. You can only live in Eretz Yisrael if you're willing to accept the notion of peace. If you're not, and peace is connected to Eretz Yisrael, So naturally, whoever doesn't accept that won't be able to live in Eretz Yisrael. So according to the Ramban, just like there's a pasuk in Achrimot and a pasuk in Kedoshim, right? Those two parashiyot in Vayikra, where it says, if you don't keep the Torah, the land will spew you forth. In other words, the land itself can't put up with certain kinds of idolatry and sexual misdemeanors. And if the people engage in that kind of activity, then the land won't put up with it. And what does the Ramban say here? The Ramban says, if you can't accept the idea of peace, the land won't be able to live with you. So that there's a, like you run in, there's a time you have to conquer the land and take it over. But then you better make peace. Because if you don't make peace with each other, then the land won't be able to hold on to you. So these are different opinions about this pasuk, right? I'm skipping all of this and I'm going to get to Rav Nachman. I want to get to Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman, introduction. Introduction to Rav Nachman. I'm going to teach you a little bit of part A, Torah, Sabbath, Dalit 64, paragraph Dalit. That's what's at the end of this page. Now, this is what Rav Nachman was, well, the way I present it. The question is this: how come everything in the Gemara is a machloket? I'll say that again. How come everything in the Gemara is a machloket? One Tana said this. Another Tana said that. One Amora said this. Another Amora said that. And the Gemara spends a lot of time, all its time, trying to explain the machloket away, resolve the machloket. Now the Rambam, who lived many years before Rav Nachman, the Rambam said that when God gave the Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu, there's only one Torah. There was no machloket. So what happened? Where did this machloket come from? So the Rambam says, you know, Am Yisrael had tough times. They went into exile. They set up a Beit Din here, set up a Beit Din there. These didn't know what those were doing, and those didn't know what these are doing. So as a result, you have disparity. But the Rambam said, we could still get back to the source, to the kernel, to the one. And therefore he wrote his book, which he called Mishneh Torah. Mishneh Torah, the kind of second Torah, and which he called it Mishneh Torah. We call it Yad Chazaka, Yad Yud Dalet, because he divided the Halakha into 14 books. We call it Yad Chazaka. In that book, the Rambam tells you what the Halakha is. He doesn't tell you what the Machloket is. Because the Rambam was committed to the idea, the Rambam, Maimonides, was committed to the idea that you could discover the truth. You know, when the Beit Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, wrote the Shulchan Aruch, I see I'm not going to make it. But when Rav Yosef Karo wrote the Shulchan Aruch, he based it on what the Rosh wrote and what the Tur wrote. And what the Rosh and the Tur? And the Rambam, thank you. But what do you mean he basically, 2 out of 3? Is that crazy? Be 2 out of 3? You have 3 giants of halakha. And then you say, what do you do in this case? But you say, well, we'll just count them. 2 against 1 is going to win. Now, that's something that a child could do. That's not something that Yosef Karo should do. Yosef Karo should be able to analyze. So what Yosef Karo said was, I can't analyze to the truth. So I have to figure out an arbitrary way of getting to the truth. And therefore, 2 against 1 is going to win. That's what Yosef Karo said. That's what we do. We to this day follow that principle. That 2 against 1 wins in the context of halakha. Context of halakha. Along came the Rav Nachman of Bratslav. And Rav Nachman of Bratslav said this. First of all, he said, I accept the position of the Arizal. Ari? Remember the Ari? No? The Arizal was born in Yerushalayim, and his mother was widowed and could not support her family. So they went to Alexandria, where she had a rich relative who took them in. In Alexandria, the Arizal studied. His Chavrusa was the man who wrote or compiled the Shita Mikubetzet, which is a compendium of statements by Rishonim on certain Masechtot of Shas. Very important. It's a very important work. His name was Bezalel Ashkenazi. Both of them, and Bezalel Ashkenazi mentions the Arizal several times in his work called the Shita Mikubetzet. They both had a teacher who we call the Radvaz, Rav David ben Zimra, who taught them both Gemara and Kabbalah. Eventually, the Arizal left Alexandria and went to Tzfat. He was in Tzfat for a very short time, but somehow made this tremendous impression on the Kabbalists of Tzfat. And he became the leading light of Kabbalism coming out of Tzfat, even though there was another great Kabbalist there, Moshe Cordovero, so they shared the titles of them. The Arizal asked himself the following question. He said, how could it be that God created, or how was it when God created the world? After all, God took up all the room. Like, every place was God. So where exactly did God put the world that he created? So the Arizal said, God created a chalal hapanui, an open, empty space. Like, you imagine, like, water or air, just moved it away and created a chalal panui, an empty space. And into that empty space, God created the world. The Ramban says, I know that this is, if you ever heard this story, it may be a little bit much, but I don't think I could do it any other way. The Ramban said that God, into this Chalal Panui, God created something Yesh Miayin, something from nothing. And then everything else that was created from the something that originally was created from nothing. And that something that created from nothing is called Iyuli in the Ramban, which is a Greek word, which means primal matter or something like that. That Chalal HaPanui has this strange distinction of being a place where there is no God. So here you have Rav Nachman, and he says, what's going on here? How is it possible that God created the world in a place where there's no God? What am I supposed to do? I'm not supposed to be with God. So Rav Nachman developed this interesting idea based on the Zohar, that when I say that there's no God in the Chalal HaPanui, I don't mean that there's no God. I mean it's just hard to perceive. It's hard to get to God. And therefore, Rav Nachman answered the question which he asked himself. He said, how could it be that there are people who don't believe in God? When Rav Nachman came to Uman, you know Uman? Where you could fly for an exorbitant rate today and eat sandwiches or something. And Rav Nachman, when he got to Uman, in Uman there were well-known, like, conservative Jews. You know, Jews who wanted to change things, Jews who wanted to make it up. So he, Rav Nachman, used to go every day and play chess with one of these guys on the back porch of his house. And the Hasidim, I know how many Hasidim there were, probably not too many, but the Hasidim got nervous. They said, this is a Rebbe, this is what a Rebbe does? He spends all his time playing chess with a non-religious Jew? This is terrible. So they asked Rav Nachman, what he's doing? And so he said, according to the story that I was told, he said, I'm trying to figure out how a person can imagine that he doesn't have a father or a mother. Which is the way he said, how could a person imagine that nobody created the world? or that the world was not created. He couldn't understand it. But then he came across this idea of the Chalal HaPanui. We're going to get to Shalom. It'll just be another couple of minutes. Don't worry. He said, how could it be that people don't think they don't have a father and a mother? He said, they're in the Chalal HaPanui. In order to create the world, God had to kind of make this Chalal HaPanui. So what is a Chalal HaPanui? It's a place where the availability of the idea of God is not so obvious. It's possible to be trapped in the Chalal HaPanui. That's why Rav Nachman said, Kol HaOlam Kulo, you know that song? Kol HaOlam Kulo Gesher Tzar Me'od. Vayikar Lo Lefachei. That's what Rav Nachman said. That when you go through the world, when you go through life in the world, Kol HaOlam Kulo Gesher Tzar Me'od. What's the Gesher? What's the bridge that is that very narrow bridge? It's a place where you still are holding on to God, to the idea that God is with you. Because if you fear, if you are consumed by fear, you might fall off of the bridge. When you fall off of the bridge, where do you fall? You fall into the Chalal HaPanui. So Rav Nachman explained, on the one hand, that we are really a faith-based religion. By that I mean that there are the way we connect to God is through faith. We believe that there is a God. We don't prove that there is a God. We can't answer the questions that are asked by questioners about God. We don't know the answer to those questions, but we know, because we have that faith, that there is a God, and that God is concerned about us. That's how we know. We don't know any other way. There's no logical position that can be defended. Okay, right? I mean, if you studied philosophy, you know that there have been attempts, but this is Rav Nachman. And therefore, Rav Nachman didn't like the Rambam. He didn't like the Rambam, but he really didn't like the Rambam. He said you shouldn't study any of the books of the Rambam because he thought that the Rambam misleads us into thinking that you could figure it out. And Rav Nachman said, you can't figure it out. Why did he say you can't figure it out? Because he used the Arizal's principle of the Chalal HaPanui. That if God took himself, so to speak, out of something, how can we say that he's there? There you have it. So the Rav Nachman said this. If you are in the world, so you're in the Chalal HaPanui. So even though your faith enables you to say that God is concerned about us and that we fear God and love God, even though we don't always get it, right, that you could say all of that, that's true about Torah as well. It's true about Torah. There is a pure Torah. There is a singularity of Torah. I use that word liberally. It's a word in physics. Physicists like that word, but I'm using it in a liberal way. There's a singularity to Torah.
Don't like singularities.
Okay. There's a singularity.
Stuck with them.
Okay. That's the difference between being in it and not being in it, right? But there's a singularity to Torah. It's just that we don't know it. We don't get it because we're the Chalal HaPanui. And therefore, when the Torah was given to Moshe Rabbeinu, what happened? Moshe Rabbeinu, they had gotten it. But then it automatically turned into a machloket. It turned into a difference of opinion because nobody could see the whole truth. No one could see the singularity of the Torah on any position. And therefore, you have machloket after machloket after machloket. So along came Rav Nachman and he said, he didn't quote the Pasuk, I'm adding it, that V'natati Shalom Ba'aretz means that the hope is that there won't be a machloket. That the hope is that if we are accepting of the covenant and we're able to follow the directives of the Torah and yearn to get it right, that we will be able to get it right. And that's what Shalom is. That's what shalom is. It's doing away, according to Rav Nachman, doing away with the machloket. There's no machloket. This machloket is based on the fact that we don't get it right, that we don't see it. But when did we get it right? Not when the Rambam says that once we got it right. And then there were wars and there were exiles and things happened. And so things are a little messed up. No, no. Rav Nachman says in the essence of Kabbalat HaTorah, it's all the shulis, right? And the essence of it, we have to recognize the fact, we have to recognize the fact that we don't get it perfectly right. That that our receptors are not able to see the truth in the Chalal HaPanui. And what we wait for is for God to miraculously show us the way, and that's called V'natati Shalom Ba'aretz. Okay. Next week, Bamidbar. Be well.